Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week, we're working through some stuff. My guest is Gwendolyn Keist, back for her second Talking Scared appearance, this time to discuss her brand new liminal as hell novel, The Haunting of Veltwood. It's a very high concept story involving an entire street that turns spectral, and, well, it's best I let Gwendolyn explain the rest. The book may well be centred on trauma and the angst we carry with us out of childhood, but we do a surprising amount of laughing in this episode, because no one laughs as generously as Gwendolyn. It made me feel almost funny and charming at times. In between the chuckles, we do talk about all sorts of things, from the many meanings of the word haunted to child-free adventures, televisual references, and just what makes the American suburbs so damn creepy. It's one of those episodes that made me admire the book even more in the aftermath. And if you like it and want more of this sort of thing, then sign up for the Patreon. You support the show whilst getting a mother ton of bonus episodes and access to our now booming Discord channel. Honestly, it's great. We talk about horror books all day long. Just go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod, sign up with my thanks. Oh, and do me a favour and leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. But now, come with me to an average street somewhere beyond the city limits. Lawns are manicured, picket fences are painted white, but something ugly lingers beneath. Let's talk scared. Well, hi, Gwendolyn, and welcome back to Talking Scared. How are you?
Just fine. So happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me back.
No, pleasure. I'm saying welcome back a lot in recent weeks. Quite a few people sort of making their second appearance on the second go-around on the show at the moment. You were on for the first time, I checked, it was August 2022, episode 106, talking about what turned out to be one of my favourite books of that year, which was your revisionist, feminist, modern, gothic. It was called Reluctant Immortals. And I recommend every listener check out that episode and that book, because I properly loved it. So nice to give like two books for the bang in this episode. Before we get into the book you're here for this time around, how has life treated you in the intervening year and a half since we last spoke?
That's a big question. I mean, good and bad, right? There's always good and bad. But in general, good. Definitely excited to be here to talk about The Haunting of Veltwood. Very excited to have another book out. That is always a great thing as a writer. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, you've certainly made a strong start on 2024. The book in question, The Haunting of Veltwood, it's hitting a lot of people's most anticipated lists. Mm. It's got a very, very high concept at its core. So what can you tell my listeners to get them up to speed for this conversation?
Yeah, so The Haunting of Veltwood is about a haunted neighborhood called the Veltwood vicinity. And 20 years ago, it just vanished off the map. The whole neighborhood and everybody in it became ghosts. And the only people who got out were these three girls. They left for college the night before. And now one of them is going to go back into the neighborhood for the first time in 20 years, hoping to find her little sister who's still trapped in there.
That's a beautifully concise summation of what's a really, really complex book. I was thinking, you know, what do I want to ask you about this? And it dawned on me that I really don't want to lead you anywhere at first, because this book is so just downright unusual, so curious, that I want to start broad and then let you take us inward.
Okay.
First question, were you aware when writing it, and are you aware now, of just how strange this story is?
I mean, it comes out of my mind, so maybe my mind is just strange. What's the line from Beetlejuice? I myself am strange and unusual. So maybe that's like part of it. But yeah, I mean, I've definitely got some feedback like that from people about it being a very strange book. It's very surreal. You know, I was just talking to somebody and I said that it's probably my most Lynchian book. It's my most, like, I love David Lynch. And I feel like, you know, if anything I've ever written has been Lynchian. It's this one. It's a very, it is an odd book. It's a strange way of telling a ghost story.
I'm so glad you've mentioned Lynch, because I've made notes about various things this made me think of, and Lynch is right up there. So that came through. This has been driving me mad, because I've never seen Twin Peaks.
Okay.
Which is ridiculous, I know. Is Twin Peaks the show that starts where all the millipedes and spiders are shown underneath the earth of suburbia? Or is that a different show?
That is Blue Velvet. That is the opening to Blue Velvet. Yes.
Yes.
It is Lynch, but that is the opening to Blue Velvet. Like, that's
right.
Like, I think, you know, almost the very beginning. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Honestly, that was driving me crazy all week, because obviously in your book, millipedes and spiders come out of the earth at certain points. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, mm-hmm, that is Lynch, but I don't know what Lynch. So thank you for scratching that itch in my brain. what I will ask is, as I say, it's got a very high concept. And then I was thinking about your bibliography, you know, Russ Maidens in particular, to an extent, Reluctant Immortals. I've read a lot of your short fiction over the years in various magazines, kind of before I knew who you were. It's a name that sticks in the mind, you know, and I think, oh, I've read that and I've read that. And it strikes me that high concepts seem very important to you. You seem to write novels about ideas that other people would only try and sustain over the length of a short story. Do you just like swinging for the fences with these massive concepts?
I think so. Like, somebody else said that to me once. It's like, you know, like other people do, because I was talking about this even before it came out. This was like, I think when I was promoting Reluctant Immortals, and somebody said, you know, most people are going to do a haunted house story. You're going to do a haunted neighborhood. And I'm like, yeah, like I'm kind of like, you know, go big or go home. Like, everything is very like intense and kind of like, yeah. So I like that, swing for the fences. I would say so. I think that it's interesting to take something that's a really big concept and then say, how can you humanize it? How can you take this really big concept but bring characters into it and make it a character-driven story, even if it's also got a high concept to it? Because that can be a challenge. Like you said, sometimes it's hard to sustain it. And I always like kind of challenging myself as I'm writing. Like, what haven't I done? And what do I think might be difficult to do in this context? And then see what kind of shakes out of it.
Okay, that reminds me of something Stephen Graham Jones said. He said he likes to write himself into a corner and then try and find a way to escape. And that always inspired me, because I'm put off by the ideas, you know, of how the hell do I tell this story? How, you know, like the really, really original idea frightens me. So I think it's quite inspiring about people who chase that frightening idea and go after it. Yeah, it would just daunt me too much, I think. I mean, you mentioned a second ago, you used the phrase ghost story. And it's emblazoned all over the copy, all over the synopsis, all the reviews, ghost story, ghost story. What I want to ask you, because I don't think it's a simple question, is in what way to you is this a ghost story?
Ah, yes. I mean, it's, you know, a kind of literal ghost story in the fact that the whole neighborhood has turned into a ghost. But to me, I think the most important aspect of it is how much the main character, Talitha, is haunted by her past. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the biggest ghost of the story, and the ghost that's kind of the most relatable to people living in the real world, because I feel like we're all in some way haunted by our past, whether it's good or bad. You know, like in this, there's a lot of bad. There's a lot of things that she hasn't dealt with from her past. But even just people we've lost that we've loved, you know, sometimes it's things that we've lost that have been good, as opposed to things that are in the past that we haven't resolved that are bad. So I feel like everybody's haunted. And to me, that's why I love ghost stories so much. And so I feel like there's the literal ghosts of the Velkwood vicinity and on Velkwood Street in this neighborhood. But then there's definitely those kind of metaphorical ghosts of the past that's really haunting her.
Well, you say the literal ghosts. And if you just want to say, Neil, you're an idiot and you've missed something, that's fine. That happens more than you'd think. Trust me. I edit scrupulously to make myself sound smarter. But I was never quite sure if they were ghosts in the sense of they are, you know, the disembodied spirits of deceased people, or whether they are people trapped in some kind of liminal time loop space thing. Is there an answer to that?
I am happy leaving that open-ended, because I agree, because I thought that might be where this is going, and it's almost a little bit of a spoiler, but kind of not, because I'm not going to give a definitive answer. But yeah, as I was writing it, I definitely went into it initially being like, oh, this is a ghost story. And as I wrote it, I'm like, if this is a ghost story, it's kind of a ghost story in a different way in terms of whether or not they're ghosts. There's a kind of almost sci-fi element to it. Yeah. People have compared it to the X-Files because it is very weird. Are they ghosts? Are they not ghosts? Are these just ghosts we haven't seen yet? Or is this something else? I'm happy leaving that open-ended for the reader to decide themselves. But yeah, it's definitely they're unusual ghosts at the very least. If they are, if you decide they are ghosts, they're definitely an unusual kind of ghost.
A lot of televisual references this week. We've had Twin Peaks, really, the X-Files. Have you seen the show From?
No, I don't think so. No.
Oh, I think you'll like it. And I'm telling listeners, I mean, a lot of my listeners like turned me onto it, but I think you'll get a kind of kick out of it because it's what this made me think of most in terms of it, of the plot, because it's basically about some people who drive into a town and then can't leave.
Okay. What's it called again?
It's just called From, F-R-O-M.
From, F-R-O-M. Yeah. Okay.
So it's kind of like Lost, but in a small American town. Every time they try and leave, they just come back into town again. And then there's thing about, are they dead? Are they somewhere else? All that. It gets very intentionally Lynchian, just weirdness upon weirdness.
I have not heard of this one. This sounds great. I'm going to look this up. I'm excited.
There have been two series, and it's just gone a little bit, it's just gone very crazy in the last few, where it's kind of bringing in sleep demons and all manner of stuff. But that element of like liminality and like what even realm are these people on? That's why Veltwood made me think of it. There's certainly some of that to it. I'm glad that I've not missed something and that it is ambiguous, because I'd rather be ambiguous than dumb.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's definitely up for interpretation, and I'm good with that. I'm good with that.
I don't get to talk about ghosts as much as you'd think on this show. What came first? The plot idea? The idea of like, you know, well, everything that happens? Or did you just set out to think, I want to try and tell a new kind of ghost story and then go looking for the new kind of ghost story?
You know, that kind of like every trope in horror, I'm kind of always thinking that. I'm like, I want to do a different kind of vampire story. So I did Reluctant Immortals. And like, you know, I pretty much every trope that's out there, I want to write something for it, whether it's a short story or a novella or a novel. So that's always in the back of my head. And I love ghosts. And so that definitely was there. But I think it was actually the concept of it sort of came together pretty quickly in terms of I knew I was going to be writing. I was like working on some different ideas for a novel, and I was thinking about Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides, which I consider that horror. I consider it existential horror. Most people wouldn't. They just say it's drama, but I consider it's like it's a horror in kind of the same vein as like Picnic at Hanging Rock. Mm-hmm. It's this very beautifully shot, but it's very disturbing. And so I was thinking about that and the neighborhood and that, and looking at some of the references she used. And one of them was this book called Suburbia by this photographer called Bill Owens. And it was from like 1973, and it's this suburban neighborhood, and there are these black and white pictures. And I found it really beautiful and really haunting. And I thought, I'd love to do a neighborhood like this. But I had promised myself after Reluctant Immortals, I was not going to do another historical horror novel. I'm like, you need to write in modern day. But then I was like, but I could create this neighborhood, and the neighborhood stuck in the past, but the rest of the story is in present day. And so that's kind of how this all came together, is I wanted to write another historical horror novel, but I'm like, you need to write in modern day, because my first three novels were all set in the past. And I'm like, you need to write in modern day, you need to challenge yourself, right? So I kind of cheated a little bit by making the neighborhood stuck in the past, but the characters kind of in the future. So that was sort of how that initially, that concept came together. And that was sort of where I took it from there.
Okay. I'm so happy you mentioned The Virgin Suicides, because you won't know this, you're not on Twitter, but I have been just referring to this book throughout as, because everyone keeps comparing it to Yellow Jackets, right? And I don't like Yellow Jackets, didn't enjoy it. Don't shoot me. I've been comparing this, I've been comping it as The Virgin Suicides meets Stephen King's The Langoliers.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
Because the tonal quality of it, that kind of, like you say, that I wouldn't go as far as saying that film is a horror film, but it's, or a horror story, but it's certainly a ghost story in it. And it's another unique way, because it's about the imprint that people leave. It's haunting, isn't it? In every possible way you can mean that word. And the weird dreamlike thing that the dreamlike thing manages to fit both the tropes of the ghost story and the tropes of kind of nostalgia and I would say boyhood, but I imagine girlhood as well. And that kind of like welds those two things together. Mm-hmm. And you are clearly, you know, going for a similar tonal thing in Veltwood. So I think if anyone enjoyed The Virgin Suicides, they'll get something from this. So yeah, I'm glad you said that. But was it a challenge writing the present day? Because I would think it'd be a challenge writing an historical thing because of research and very similitude. But did you find it harder to write in the here and now?
You know, I did. I'm doing better with it now. Like, that's like a thing. And it's funny. I've been talking to my husband a lot about this. And like, this book, more so than anything else I've ever written, The Haunting of Velkwood, like I kind of dealt with some of my own things that have happened, you know, to me or to people I knew and just the experiences. And I almost felt like I was kind of more stuck in the past myself until writing this book. And now, like, the two things I'm working on now are both set in present day. You know, they deal with things that happened to people before, because everything does to a certain extent. But it almost is like this is the book that bridged me of being like able to put some things in the past that needed to be in the past. So it's like, for me, it was easier to write in the past. I also have like a background in doing research, you know, and so I love research and it's just fun. That's like almost like the fun stuff for me. So I never really had problems writing historical horror. It was always like, oh, but present day doesn't inspire me. And now I'm kind of like, okay, maybe that was because I was too stuck in the past and now I'm able to move forward. I'm sure I'll write more historical horror anyways, but it is interesting that this was like that kind of bridge, this kind of book that like straddled both.
Yeah, because I got the sense that you were working through some things in this book.
I love that. I honestly want to use that as the pull quote from this. I got the feeling you were working through some things with this one. That is amazing.
I've got pretty good at guessing that. And I don't tend to ask about it because it's none of my fucking business. But I can tend to tell when people are putting more of their own emotional experience into a book. I don't know how. I think it's a tonal thing, you know. I mean, obviously, everyone puts something of themselves into a book, but there's a sort of pitch or a register that comes through when it's dredged from the gut, you know.
Yes.
It's interesting that you have kind of used it as a catharsis, and now you're just happy in the present day. That's a really good outcome, right? People pay thousands in therapy for that kind of thing.
Seriously, there's a lot to be said for that. This book was put me through a lot writing it. And even now talking about it sometimes is like, oh, I've got to kind of go back into that mindset. But it was an experience. It was an experience. And it's been a positive one overall. So that's very good. But I do love that. It's like you were working through some things. That's amazing.
Well, you can rest assured, I'm only going to ask about Talitha and Talitha's motivations. What you want to tell me is up to you. The one thing I will ask about you is a quote that I pulled the minute I read it, because I was like, that is just excellent. So there, Talitha goes back to Velkwood. She's kind of commissioned, I suppose, by this guy called Jack, who is a paranormal researcher. And I'm not going to lie, all the way through, I didn't trust Jack. And I won't say I won't say if I was right or not, but I didn't trust him. So, but there's a quote that Talitha's friend Brett, who's also female, Brett says about Jack, nobody ordinary has ever been this obsessed with ghosts. And that felt like you were a sort of song to the choir, a kind of nod to your audience, because we are, of course, all obsessed with ghosts. And I want to ask, are you obsessed with ghosts? Was that you kind of taking the piss out of yourself a little bit?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I love ghosts. They are my favorite out of all the horror tropes, without a doubt. So it's like, you know, I'm working on a novella now. It's not really a ghost story, but I've been able to work in some kind of ghostly elements. And I'm like, there I am with my ghosts again. Like, it's going to be like forever. Like, I just love them. So yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Why are ghosts your favorite? That's an interesting thing to say to people, to someone like me.
You know, again, I think it is because of the past and so much of like my own past of trying to work through it. And it felt like it's always felt like a way that I can do it and kind of make it literal. And in some ways, you know, being able to actually make something from your past literal on the page is helpful, because it's like, you know, we can't bring the past into the present, right? But a ghost in a story can be. And it's almost like you can look at that thing more concretely than you can with, you know, things that have happened that just kind of exist in your memories.
Yeah, because that's something I found, this is a general musing now, but something I found really interesting in that's happening in the last few years, I mean, I'm sure it happens before that, but it's really become a thing, is that ghosts always used to be manifestations of kind of past injustice. You know, they were often, you go to someone, it'd be a site where something bad happened, terrible things happen, and it's like a reenactment and sometimes a sort of putting right of past wrongs. And it's kind of like history sort of read in tooth and claw. What I've noticed, and this comes back to me saying like you were going through some things, is that more and more and more people are writing about ghosts as much more to do with, I don't know, manifestations of trauma, of personal angst. Do you know what I mean? Where ghosts are, they're not about historical things anymore. They're about someone's childhood, someone's adolescence, things that went wrong. And I'm seeing that loads. Is it because we're all a highly, you know, therapeutic culture now, do you think? We're all way more on board with mental health and stuff.
I do think that that's a good observation, is I do think that now, more so than even like 15, 20 years ago, we talk more about mental health and about, you know, the need for dealing with these things and for processing them. So I think that that's become a more appealing way of looking at it and of seeing ghosts as being this kind of, like you said, manifestation of these past traumas or past grief. So yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. I'm trying to find those ways through to talk about things that a lot of times people didn't want to talk about. And so I think that that's, you know, a ghost story can be almost like a more safe way of doing that.
Yeah, because you put it into one thing and then you, that story ends with that thing being banished. It's pure catharsis, isn't it? It's a talking cure. Uh-huh. You know, you're haunted and you are literally exorcised. Yeah. So maybe that's why demons have come back. Maybe we have demons now because we're all dealing with anxiety and we're all dealing with mental health problems. We're all literally aware of our demons more. Maybe that's why they've been in vogue for the last 20 years since the world went to shit. back to Velkwood. These three women who escape from Velkwood, they have personal and shared trauma in their adolescence. And you handle it very sensitively, almost obscurely. It's alluded to rather than explicit. But at the same time, we all know what's happening, particularly to Brett.
Yeah.
And it feels right that the abuse, an abuse it is obscured, both for sensitivity and also because of the whole perfect white picket fence exterior that hides horror, you know, the things that go hinted at but unspoken. Was that an important approach for you?
It was. It was really important. And it's something that, you know, I wanted to deal with these different types of trauma. And like you said, all three of the girls who escaped, Brett, Talitha, and Grace, all have their own traumas. And they're all very different traumas. And I didn't want to, you know, linger on that because I think that can be really exploitive. And that's something that I find very unappealing in horror movies. It's like, if you really just stay on that trauma, especially of women, like, we know what that trauma is. We as a society can fill in a lot of blanks as to the different things that can happen to women. And so I didn't want to spend a lot of time dealing with the act, but much more of the aftermath of that. So absolutely, that was, I'm glad, I'm always glad. Several people have said that, you know, the abuse aspect of it was definitely, you know, they felt that it was dealt with, you know, sensitively, and that's important to me. So it's good to hear.
And it also wouldn't really add anything to this story, would it? Because, you know, you're not writing Jack Ketchum's The Girl Next Door. It's not really about the details of what's done. It's about the aftermath.
The aftermath, yeah.
What it's left these three women shaken by, I suppose.
It's interesting with Brett's character. A lot of the things that happened to her happened to people I knew. And so Talitha being the main character, a lot of the things that happened to Talitha did happen to me. Some of her trauma is much more direct to my own trauma. But part of that also is sometimes when you're young and you have no power and you know someone in your life is being hurt the way Brett is being hurt, and you have no power to do anything because you're young. Like, there's nothing, you know, nobody listens to you when you're young. And so that was something of like trying to work through, because I think Talitha has some survivor's guilt over that as well, that she she knows that some terrible things happened to Brett when they were young and she wasn't able to do anything. And so it's something that she's still struggling with even now. And that's a big part of the story. So that's definitely part of it. It's ironic. I'm actually going to bring this up because my dad does not like this book that I wrote. It's the only book of mine he doesn't like because Brett's stepdad is so terrible. And he thinks that everybody's going to think that's your dad. I'm like, no, dad. Like, that's not even the viewpoint character, but he is not a fan of this book because Brett's stepdad is so absolutely horrible. And like, that's not based on you, dad.
That's quite funny because Talitha's dad is dead and he's kind of eulogized and put on a pedestal. So
right? I want to be like, yes, dad, like her dad wasn't always there when she needed him. I'm like, maybe that should be your hint, but she loves him very much, dad. But yeah, so that's, I have no idea if he'll listen to this or not, but hi, dad, if you're listening.
It's all right, Mr. Keist, you're off the hook. It's fine. Sorry, your poor dad. Yeah, I think that about stories, like some of the things I've written and never published, like are often quite about my parents and they are damning. So no, one of the things you said there is about Talitha's guilt about, you know, things that weren't done. But one of the creepiest things is how often things are obviously happening to Brett and mm-hmm. the rest of this tiny little community, this street, before mm-hmm. it becomes haunted and cut off, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. they're already kind of haunted and cut off because they just, it's just like gossip and side eyes and no one mm-hmm. intervenes. And there's a horror to that, to these things happening quite literally in bright daylight. And I found it interesting that when Talitha goes back, this town is constantly mm-hmm. captured in bright daylight as if to make mm-hmm. that point that these things happen out in the open. Yeah. And no mm-hmm. one reacts.
Yeah, honestly, I would say that the moment in the book that I consider the biggest horror moment is actually that moment. And I don't feel like this is a spoiler because of everything we're talking about anyways. But there's this moment when everybody knows what's happening to Brett and the whole neighborhood sees it because she comes outside and she's very upset. And they all just one by one turn away. Mm. And to me, that is the biggest horror moment in the whole book, even more so than any of the ghostly elements, because like you said, it's real. You know, I knew people who had very bad things happening to them. And a lot of times people would just gossip about the girl. So she's just difficult or she's just a troublemaker or something like that, because a lot of times people are acting out in ways trying to get people to pay attention and nobody does. And so to me, like, the biggest horror moment is that moment that honestly is the most realistic. And like you said, is long before any of the ghosts have shown up. And when Talitha's young, like I said, like it's hard to do anything when you're young. Nobody takes you seriously. But even if adults don't know what to do, like, you don't need to kind of do that blame the victim thing of like, oh, well, that girl's just being difficult, because that's easier than dealing with the fact that something bad is happening to her. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's all about adults and, you know, the sort of disappointment that you eventually end up having in adults, because you think they are arbiters of all that's good. Then you realize, oh, no, they're just as screwed up as kids are. They're just kids with a few more wrinkles. You know, nothing changes.
It's really true. It's so horrifyingly true. Like, I remember seeing this tweet about something to the effect of, like, I didn't think adults, you know, I always wondered if adults didn't really know what they were doing, but I never realized the situation was this dire. And I love that because it's true. Like, you think as a kid, oh, you know, I'll understand this when I get older. And then you get older, I'm like, I don't understand that any better now. And if anything, I understand it less. And so, yeah, I like that it's just kids with more wrinkles. That's a really great way of describing adulthood.
I turned 40 this year and I'm like, oh my God, by now what I don't know, I'm not going to know. So I'm screwed. You know, it's just.
I just turned 40 this month. So this is like, we're the same age. And that's like a big moment because you're now I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to have to either get things on track in certain ways, or this is just the way I am and I need to get used to it.
Well, that's it. Everyone says that like your 20s are a mess and your 30s, you get your shit together. And I'm like, I have not got my shit together. I don't know when it's going to happen now.
Yeah, I know.
I'm already on the downhill slope. When do I get it together? Like, it's just kind of like freewheeling to death now, basically.
Yeah, I like that you're on the downward slope. That's what I'm thinking. I'm like, honestly, there's a good chance it's halfway over now. So, like, I really got to get some things together at this point.
I run a podcast for a living. You know what I mean? Like, I've got nothing together. I'm basically, I have to die before I need a pension. That's the deal.
Oh, I've often said that millennials, our retirement plan is to just not live to be that old. Yeah. It's so horrible. Talk about existential horror. I'm like, yeah there's not going to be, I'm like, yeah, my retirement plan is pretty much a big question mark.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I'm really glad we've talked about age, because you just reminded me of something I wanted to ask and didn't make a note of. Yes, I'm glad. Basically, I don't want to ask, the same boring old question about, writing women in horror, like we've all, heard it all before. But I do want to ask specifically about writing women of a certain age in horror.
Yes.
Because Talitha is in her 40s. She's on that, that balance beam between Gen X and millennial.
Yeah.
Like I am, and millennial date of birth, Gen X mindset, I suppose.
Yeah.
I realized that how few female characters I've read from that demograph.
Yes, same. That is a thing that I've only realized over the last few years, really, now that, as I was approaching 40, I'm like, even I, when I first started writing, wrote a lot more coming of age. Now, my first novel, The Rust Maidens, had a dual timeline. Most of it was when the character was 18, but some of it was when she was in her 40s. So I at least had done that. But I did realize, and as I was writing Reluctant Immortals in particular, they're immortal. They're about in their early 20s or so, early to mid 20s. And I'm like, okay, I need, because there's not that many middle-aged women or women older than middle age in horror. And oftentimes when they're there, they're a supporting character, or if they have any kind of, it's always that they're a mother.
Yes.
It's always, oh, the whole thing. And I don't have kids. And so obviously those stories are important too. I'm not saying that they're not, but I'm not a mother, and I would like to see more middle-aged characters that are women that aren't mothers, or if they are mothers, that's not the primary source of, what's going on with them. They can be a mother, but they have other things happening. So that's a big thing for me. And as I was writing this, that was very much in my mind. And the two projects I'm working on now, both are dealing with women in their 40s. And I'm like, this needs to be something we need more of. It really is. I see even other women about my age, we still tend to write younger. We write women in their teens. We write women in their 20s. But once you get into your 30s and 40s and beyond, we don't have a lot of female characters. So it's something I'm really thinking about, that we need more in the genre for sure.
Yeah, it only struck me reading this book. Yeah, because they're all either, teens and 20-somethings or matriarchs. There's a real rich vein of horror at the minute about women coming to terms with either not wanting children or having children and hating it and stuff like that.
Mm.
But even then, that's still about children, whereas you don't really mention once in this that Talitha has or doesn't have kids. It's just kind of not part of her life or Brett's, and me and my wife don't have kids, and I mean, it's not for me to say because I'm a guy, but sod it, I kind of want to see those characters too, that endorsement of the fact that it's okay to not only not have kids, but also to not have to tussle with not having kids, that it's just okay,
Yes. One of the things I found interesting as I've gotten older, as a woman who doesn't have children, is there's not a lot of scripts. There's not a lot of social scripts for women once you get to a certain age if you don't have kids. And it's like you said, it's like, people might be disappointed in you or might be irritated with you, but they don't know what to do with you. And I think it's going to be interesting because I think there's a lot of millennial women who aren't having children. And so I think in the next 10 to 20 years, we're going to start getting new narratives that we haven't ever seen before, because we have this kind of new path through that people are very proudly childless. And even when people were childless in previous generations, a lot of times it still wasn't talked about. It was like that couple that just didn't have kids, or that woman who didn't get married and didn't have children or whatever. But now it's really something that we talk about. And, a lot of millennials are like, I just don't want to have kids. And it's not a thing that we make as many apologies for or keep as quiet. So I actually think it'll be interesting to see over the next 10 and 20 years of writers like me who are getting older and just don't have kids and are talking about or writing about it or not writing about that particular aspect, like you said, because I didn't even think about it. You're right. Brett and Talitha just never, I don't think they ever mentioned kids. Like the only kid that Talitha cares about is her little sister who's stuck in the neighborhood. But that's it. It's never like, oh, I really wish I had a kid Sophie's age. Like, that never even occurred to me to write, because that wasn't what the story was about.
Yeah. I think it's going to be cool in genre fiction in particular, these new narratives that you're talking about, because it's going to end up, we're going to have a lot of stories where characters are able to have adventures, without having to deal with, because it used to be right, these characters want to go on an adventure, so there has to be a reason that they can. Oh, they've lost a child, they can't. How many stories start with someone losing a child and that's the catalyst for them to go somewhere and have an adventure? Now it's going to be good if in like the next 10 years you know, a 45-year-old couple can just go and have an adventure, and you know, horrible things can befall them in some part of the world, but they haven't had to either lose a child or tussle with being, you know, childless to do it. That'll be great. It's a whole new cast of characters to go off and have awful experiences.
And exactly. And I love that you use the word adventure, because that's something that, like, I've talked to my husband about in stories, men can have adventures at any age and we are totally okay in any genre. You know, we don't care if James Bond was played by an older Sean Connery or a younger Sean Connery. Men can have adventures at any age, but women, we often think if they're going to have adventures, they're usually teenagers or in their early 20s. And the reason is often because of parenthood. The idea of you're older, you're not going to be able to have this adventure. Or like you said, it'll need to be, oh, you lost a child, or what are we going to do with the children? When you have childless women who are older, you actually take out this unnecessary plot device in some ways, or this plot complication. And now they can go on adventures as easily. And honestly, women can go on adventures whether they have children or not. But the idea in a story that you have this kind of plot complication of like, okay, so we can only have these younger women on adventures. But I love that you use that word, because that is the word I've often used to talk about it. Men can have adventures at any age. Women usually have them when they're younger in literature. So I'm excited. Like you said, horrible things will befall them. Let's have lots of terrible horror adventures for middle-aged women. Let's do it.
Indeed, yeah. Yeah, you can credit my wife, by the way, for that, the adventure thing, because my wife is someone who is very much up for a lifetime of adventures without children. Aww. So we're basically collecting other late millennial friends. We plan to have like some big summer camp that we have when we're all 80 and have no one to look after us, and we can just like take care of each other. That's the plan. But now that we've pissed off the fundamentalist Christian right, let's get back to the horror. We can piss them off even more, because in one of the many ways that this novel is about haunting, it's about the sort of long coming out of a queer woman, you know, a long journey towards love and self-acceptance. And this is Talitha and Brett to an extent. That's another form of haunting, right? The homophobia and the shame that Talitha is burdened with.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So that's a big part of the story. And that's really her main haunting, that and losing her sister, but is really like her mother's lack of acceptance in her love for Brett. This is a little bit of a spoiler, but that's okay. You get pretty much from kind of chapter one that there's definitely something going on with Brett and Talitha. And so that's a big part of her haunting, and the thing that she has to deal with, and that ghost that's been following her is kind of like that shame about who she is and trying to deal with that in a way that she can move forward.
Mm. And it brings us back to that suburbia thing. Because it just seemed, and this is, I'm going to say such a naive thing now, and all my like LGBTQ listeners are going to just like roll their eyes. But because I'm, you know, a straight, cis, white guy, I've never had any problems with any of that stuff. So it strikes me as insane to think that in the 90s, you know, it seems so recent that would have been quite so salacious in a town in North America, you know, and it's the same in the UK. And it feels like this should have to be 50 years earlier for the reaction to be what it is. You know, I had to keep reminding myself that, no, you've had it easy, Neil.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people have a lot of nostalgia for the 90s. But like that, one of the big things I remember is the homophobia. And, you know, I'm bisexual and it took me forever to come out about it. There was a lot of reasons, some of the reasons I deal with in the book. But other reasons, you know, it really was, you know, a lack of acceptance. And the 90s were scary if you were queer. They were really scary. And like you said, it feels like that's not that long ago. It shouldn't have been that bad. And obviously times before that were worse. It's, you know, the 90s were better, I think, than like the 50s, for example. But, you know, it was still very bad. There was a lot of homophobia. They were still passing a lot of laws in America about, you know, making sure, like, you know, what was it? It was... the Defense of Marriage Act was passed in like the mid 90s. And it was, you know, passed under a Democrat president. I mean, that's what we were at that point. You know, it was like everybody hated the queer community at that point in America. And it's weird. It's weird to realize how recent that was, because it really doesn't, it's stunning that these things happen. And it's stunning that, you know, in America, we've had same-sex marriage for less than 10 years. And, you know, and it's always going to be precarious. You know, our rights are always precarious everywhere, but especially in America, unfortunately. And so it is. It's frightening. It's good to see how far we've come, but it's always scary of how you can fall back again, because nothing is guaranteed, because prejudice and bigotry and everything. It's scary. It's scary.
Well, if we're talking about sort of Velkwood as representative of America, we need to talk about just the principle of suburbia. So you mentioned this book, this Bill Owens book, this Suburbia.
Yes.
I saw you mention that in a different interview, so I made a note of it. Have you ever come across the work of Gregory Crudson?
No, I don't think so.
I've been so excited to tell you about this.
Okay.
Gwendolyn. I'm not into art or photography at all. It leaves me. I don't have a vocabulary for it. I know what I like. I'm just an absolute primitive. But Gregory Crudson is this photographer who made this coffee table book called Twilight. I think if you see it, you'll be like, those are photographs of Velkwood.
Oh my gosh. I'm so excited.
It's these really, really uncanny shots of just everyday American suburbia, but in every shot something is a bit weird. So like, okay. So I love it, because like everyone's like a short story prompt. So like there's one where a guy is looking into the back of an ambulance and he's holding balloons and he's just let the balloons go as if he's been shot by something. There's one where like a kitchen door is open in a house and mist is pouring out, and it's like, well, what's that about? It's just the American uncanny. And I think, yeah, I couldn't separate the two in my head.
Okay, I'm going to look this up. I can't wait. Like, I don't think I know this. I don't think I've heard of this one. I looked through a lot of different, like, suburbia photography books and everything, but I don't think I came across this. I love this. This makes me so happy.
I think you'll like it. And listeners, check it out, because you'll see what I'm talking about. But suburbia, did you have a suburban childhood, Gwendolyn?
I really didn't. I grew up just like, it was just a small town. It was not really suburban, because I consider small towns are slightly different than suburbia, or, you know, slightly different than more rural areas, slightly different, you know. I still think people are people all over. That's like a quote from the Twilight Zone I always use. I don't necessarily think that, you know, some people are like, this is the best place to live. And I'm like, any place can be good and any place can be bad. I kind of think it might not be great anywhere, but like, I'm sure I'm wrong. There's, you know, there's probably some place that's nice, but it was much more small town, which is a kind of different dynamic. But my cousins that I spent a lot of time with lived in an allotment that, even though it wasn't exactly suburbia, it looked a lot like suburbia. It wasn't kind of a suburb necessarily of anywhere. It was more of a small town, but it looked just like every suburban allotment I've ever seen, like in other places or in film or in TV. And so every time I think about suburbia, I think about where they grew up. That was my experience with it, is kind of still as an outsider to it. And that's kind of how I always look at it.
But it's creepy, right?
It is. Yeah.
Do you have any theories on why it's just so eerie?
Well, you know, a lot of towns and cities grow up naturally, right? So they're not planned. I think planned communities tend to be weird, because it's like they just show up somewhere. When people just naturally move somewhere because there's work or there's something, you know, but when you plan a community, there's something artificial about it right from the get-go. And so I think that kind of artificiality, and usually the houses are kind of generic. Again, when houses build up naturally, they're going to build up at different times. So they're going to have slightly different styles. But suburbia has that tendency to all look the same. And so it's got a very artificial feel. And also, maybe this is mean, but a lot of times people with a little bit more money live in suburbia. And a lot of times people with more money are kind of mean. Like, that's, again, I'm sure there's nice rich people out there, but usually the more money people have, like, the more they want to push others out. And I think suburbia is a lot of times separate in some way. They have separated themselves from maybe people they don't want to be associated with. And so there's a lot of artificiality. There's a lot of that kind of, you know, sameness, that cookie cutterness. And there is this sense of, we're the insiders, you're the outsiders, stay out. And so I think there is that kind of unfriendliness that can a lot of times, I'm sure not always. If somebody out there lives in suburbia, I'm sure you're a very nice person, but I do think that that can be a tendency of suburbia, of pushing others out.
Yes, and well, and quite literally, your suburb is kind of, it not only pushes people out, it's also trying to eat everything around it as well.
So it's a, yes.
Generally, yes. Like, if suburbia was the blob, you know, but...
Yeah.
But there's a quote, is when you said about things looking the same and that kind of weirdness, there's a quote I pulled out, which is kind of a nondescript quote, this, but I think that's kind of the point. So you describe when Talitha wakes up, she blacks out and she wakes up in this house, and she describes it as, quote, a house as sanitized and barren as a hospital suite, everything the color of eggshells, the color of nothing. And that absence of detail is scarier than the most ornate gothic mansion. Do you know what I mean? It's like a new thing that we've learned to be scared of. For years, we were scared of the ornate Baroque mansion on the hill. Now we're scared of the thing that is just generic. And it's really, really unnerving. And I just don't know why that's happened, but it definitely has.
Yeah, that's how I feel whenever I was describing those particular houses. It was like, because originally I was like, oh, do I want to go into great detail about it? I'm like, no, because what scares me the most is the idea that she would just go into this place and it would just feel like nothing. And it would just feel so barren that you really have nothing to hold on to. Your eye has nothing to hold on to. You physically have nothing to hold on to. It's so generic. It's so empty. And that kind of emptiness is, I think, very scary.
And it brings us, doesn't it? Well, for a start, actually, what it reminded me of was the films of like Andy Kaufman.
Okay.
Those weird, like, just no spaces that just, it's unnerving and you don't know why. But that's very Lynchian. It all kind of starts tied together in a weave. But what it really conveys is the uncanny, you know, the true uncanny. And I've said this a million times on the show, but just to, again, for new listeners, the uncanny means something specific. It literally it comes from the German phrase, the unheimlich, which means the unhomely, something which looks recognizable and like home, but is actually the opposite of that, which I think works for Veltwood in a number of ways, because it is home, but it's the opposite of home.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
So it feels like you are definitely going for the uncanny, but there are two details that I want to pick up on, two specific things that I just think they're really creepy. And the first is these scientists who are investigating Veltwood. You write them in such a weird way.
I just had an interview before this, so the person pointed that out too. I love that. So the researcher, so we have the lead researcher that is, that's Jack. That's who brings Talitha sort of into the story. He's sort of the inciting event. I think that's how my editor described him. Like, that's really good. He is kind of the inciting event because he's the person who brings her back to the street. But he works with these researchers and they are written as being, Talitha cannot tell them apart. There are all these researchers. They introduce themselves to her. We never learn their names because she can't hold on to their names. And so it's just like, and they very much kind of just treat her almost like a specimen. And they're kind of rotating in and out. And she never really gets to know any of them. And it's just this very kind of dizzying experience for her and then sort of for the reader. I went back and forth initially if I wanted all of the researchers to be, you know, okay, we're going to have all these different characters. And then I thought, no, because that isn't what Talitha cares about right now. Talitha cares about going back into this neighborhood and kind of settling up with the ghosts of the past. And we also get the impression very early on, Talitha has terrible social skills. And so she's not very good at interacting with people. And I actually thought it made more sense that she would meet a bunch of new people and she wouldn't be able to figure out who they are. And I think sometimes, like, I hope I'm not the only one, but if you go to a place and you're introduced to like five or six people at once and you're maybe more of an introvert, and especially after the pandemic when maybe a lot of us haven't had as many social interactions for a little while, it can be hard to remember who everyone is and what everyone does. And to me, that's what the experience of the researchers are to her. She's very stressed out. She's going back to this place that she hasn't been for so long. And she's meeting all these people who don't really necessarily care about her. They care about her role in this overall mystery. And so it's like they're not really that invested in her. She's not really that invested in them. So there's this weird kind of dizzying experience for her of interacting with these people that she never gets to know and they never get to know her.
It's eerie because they're almost like automatons. At other times, they're kind of like ghosts. I mean, one character even describes one person who is a ghost called them ghosts, which I thought was an interesting flip reverse. But yeah, they're one of the... If I was picturing this as a film, I pitched them as kind of like big, almost like crash test dummies in clothes, you know, faceless, like soft, pliant, weird people. Like, yeah, creepy detail. The other thing, and this might just be me completely overinterpreting.
Okay.
There's this diner on the edge of the vicinity. And that's what first made me think of when I said the Gregory Crewson photographs. Because it's this piece of like this all-American motif that should be the most homely thing ever. But the patrons inside are a bit weird and a bit scary. And maybe it's my terrible work ethic. But it seems to me that it's weird that Dolores the server is on shift all the time.
Yeah, she is, right? She's always there. She's like working like constantly, yes.
But it feels like there's more going on with Dolores. Like she's a weird character that it feels like there's something there that I've not quite got to. Like she's the, like, I don't know, like she's really, like she knows more than she's letting on and she's always there commenting.
Yes, she's kind of like that Greek choir, right? Like she's the one who's kind of like got a lot more insight than Talitha thinks at first, because Talitha like kind of sees her and is like, yeah, I think I remember this woman from when I was young. But the woman definitely remembers her and like remembers a lot of what happened before the Velkwood Street turned into a ghost. And so, yeah, she's definitely got everybody's number. You can tell this story probably from Dolores's point of view and actually have a unique story from her point of view because of the vantage point that she has in this town and having been here from before that Velkwood Street turned into a ghost till after. So, yeah.
Well, that's funny, because I just did a round table on The Haunting of Hill House with a few guests. And I was talking about how what I really want is I want the story from Mrs. Dudley's perspective, the housekeeper who's been there all this time. What has she seen? And it's kind of the same with Dolores. Like,
it is.
She will have seen some weird stuff that no one else will know about. And I always find that kind of, I don't know, that like enticingly creepy. The person who stayed, you know, Mike Hanlon in It, the person who stayed behind and has seen more than any of the protagonists. It's a it's a cool perspective on a story. Yeah. I think she's weird. She's always working. Go home, Dolores. Put your feet up, love.
That's amazing. I love that.
But I mean, yeah. So all I'll say is we talked about uncanny. If anyone out there is looking to like study the uncanny, I know I have academic people listening, students. I have, you know, people, if you're writing an article, if you want a real, I don't know, capsule of what the contemporary uncanny looks like, I would read Gwendolyn's book because it nails that sort of slippery modern malaise of the uncanny. Maybe that's a good segue into my final two questions. Could I ask you to recommend a book for my listeners that you think they'd enjoy?
Yeah. So I'm going to recommend The Daughters of Block Island by Krista Carman. It is a very recent Bram Stoker Award nominee for first novel. And I blurbed it. I remember when she was writing, and she and I are friends, full disclosure, but you know, I love the book. It's absolutely beautiful. It's a kind of different take on the Gothic, kind of reinventing the Gothic. And I, of course, love all Gothic horror. So yeah, it's a great book. And I definitely think people should pick it up if you haven't read it yet.
What's it? Cause I can picture it, the really striking, like reddy purple cover. What's the basic outline? What's the basic premise?
It's about two sisters who have not met, and they were like separated when they were young, and one of them, I don't think this is a too much of a spoiler, I think it's on the back cover, hopefully it's not, but one of them gets murdered before they can even really like meet up, and the other one has to unravel the mystery of what happened to her estranged sister, her long lost sister. So yeah, okay. I mean, it starts in this very interesting kind of like Gothic idea, but it's modern day, and it's a very neat book.
Okay, right. I'm aware of it. I've seen it floating around on my Instagram feed.
Yeah.
What's the author again?
Krista Carman.
Krista Carman. Okay. I'll put it on the show notes. My final question, Gwendolyn, you're the second person to answer this new and improved closing question. What was the last thing that really scared you?
I honestly want to just say like the news, which is like totally like a lame answer, even if it's true, but definitely thinking about the future. I think that that's one of the things that scares me most of like how both personally how to move into the future, but also like how we as a society, like it's scary sometimes thinking what does our future look like? What I don't have kids, but I often think like, what does the future look like for young people? I mean, you know, that's a very scary thing. So I feel like the last time I really thought about the future and, you know, what does that mean? What does that mean for me as an individual? What does that mean for us as human beings? That was definitely the last time I was scared.
Okay. We're all basically just sitting here waiting for November, aren't we, to see what happens to like America and then the world.
Right. And that's something that I always feel like awful as about, because it's like if bad things happen to America, like we're also interconnected. If bad things happen to you guys in the UK, bad things will happen to us. We're also interconnected. So it's like anytime something bad is happening in America, I'm always like, this will probably affect other people. There's this like just this ripple effect. So it is scary. Mm. We're doing our best. I can promise everybody out there we're trying here in America. Lots of us are trying to make sure it's a better future.
I'll be sitting there watching John King on CNN go slowly mad over 3 days. That's what I did last time. I was laying on the couch for 3 days just watching the election coverage percolating in my own just angst. And then watched it for 3 days, then went for a quick run and missed Biden winning like after all that time.
Okay, so if it looks like we don't know what's going to happen and we need one of ours, we need you to go for a run, okay? Yeah. This is like, you know, if a butterfly flaps its wings. If Neil goes for a run, Biden will win a pivotal state. So, okay.
Oh, don't. I'll be running for the next 6 months. Don't. Jesus. Anyway. Let's end on that optimistic note.
Yes. Yes.
But thank you for speaking to me. I mean, the book, as I've probably hopefully made clear, is an absolute puzzle box of a thing about all different kinds of hauntings. So I'm sure everyone who's listening will be intrigued. It's out now by the time you hear this, so go check it out. But Gwendolyn Keist, thank you for talking scared.
Thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.
Okay, I've never seen Twin Peaks, right? Accept it. Deal with it. Don't punch my face. I just came to it too late, and then when I tried, it all seemed horribly dated and not in a good way, and I've already seen the Bob coming over the sofa meme, so there seems no need for me to watch the damn thing. Feel free to tell me I'm wrong, right? And I'll consider it. I hear Fire Walk With Me is terrifying, so there's that. Yeah, and just to say, if that has made your blood boil, I may as well tell you now that I haven't seen a single episode of Buffy either. Not one single episode. It feels like I should possibly hand my goth credentials back. But I do know enough about David Lynch's work, at least to say that I think fans of his will find a lot to latch onto in Veltwood. Gwendolyn has written a singularly uncanny novel. I was trying to think how to describe it, and the best I can come up with is this. It reads like disorientation pinned down in prose. If you like liminal, this is liminal. It's actually one of those books, like I said in the intro, that I admire much more having spoken to the author, because this conversation with Gwendolyn infused what I thought was a very cold book on first reading with a lot of human warmth that I'd perhaps not thought about deeply enough. It's one of the curses of reading at such pace for this show. I do miss stuff or sometimes misinterpret stuff. One thing I will say is that the rules of this microcosmic weird universe that she sets up, they change, they flutter, and they fluctuate, and there's no rigid sense of what's going on. And you might want to go into Veltwood pre-warned that you will not get all the answers. And I think knowing that in advance will significantly change your reading experience. I think for the better. This is not about firm answers. It's a book about interpretation, I guess, which I think is best summed up in all the different ways that we talked about what the word haunting means in this book. Because one of the things I noticed and didn't mention to Gwendolyn is the title itself, The Haunting of Veltwood, could apply to Veltwood, the vicinity, the street, or Talitha Veltwood herself, because the street is named for her family. So the haunting of the street or the haunting of our character, you decide. As ever, do let me know what you think of the book and any thoughts you have on this conversation. And also let me know what you think of Gregory Crewton's photography. Because again, that book of his photos is called Twilight. And I just adore the aesthetic. And I've never seen it matched quite like Gwendolyn matched it in this book. So let me know what you think about all of that. I'll put some photos online. Email me at talkingscaredpod@gmail.com or find me on pretty much all social media at talkscaredpod. Now, this week, got to do a quick shout out for my patrons, if you don't mind. They deserve it because they keep this show on the road, so to speak. And even though I never leave my desk, if you want to sign up and get loads of bonus stuff and Discord access, then it's patreon.com/talkingscaredpod. Really easy, really appreciated. But a big thanks to all the people who have already signed up recently. Right, it's a big list, so big breath. Rosie W, Rachel G, Mandy B, Dorothy, Rachel B, Brian H, Troy, Samuel, Robert C, Sean N, Nick M, Lucy, Dale S, Dynamic Duo, great name, Stephen B, Tiffany, Erin, Elena, Dustin P, Carmen, Andrew CC, someone called True Crime Nana, fantastic handle, Francis R, Lauren, TJ, Matt M, Rossifer, Cecilia, Koi Koi, I think I said that right, Ali W, Tim S, who is my Counting Crows buddy, Kelsey S, Stephanie, John W, Eric H, Flippy Spoon, wonderful, Jared, Nathan G, Dr. Crone, Erin B, Clement C, Lumine, Ron B, Lindsay H, Rory S, Britt, Deandra, Ashley E. Take a breath, Neil. Take a pause. It's like run up a hill. Onwards. Noah S, Jason W, Marjo, Paul, Vanessa, Belez, Sean C, Wendy, out there in the Pacific Northwest running. How you doing? Meredith, Luella, Amanda C, Lindsay M, Rachel W, Michael T, Shannon, Gabe, Ben H, Stephen W, we're nearly there, folks, Jessica L, Courtney C, Dory, Sean M, and Ralph. Whew. Thanks so much, folks. That's going all the way back to like the back end of last year. So, yeah, a lot of you, and you really do make a massive difference to this little indie podcast. And before I go, I want to say a very special hello to the Courts family. Aaron, just thanks so much, mate, for all your positivity and love. And a massive hello to Isabella and Emery, who may be my youngest listeners, I believe. All I can say is, I love that you're into horror, and I'm so sorry I curse so much. Right, I'm back next week with a fun one. Joshua Hull, screenwriter of the Eldritch Glory Hole horror movie Glorious, and author of the new Hole in the Ground monster novella, Mouth. The little book that could. It's a delight. Until then, though, put the bad behind you, keep the good ahead of you, and never let an old friendship go to waste. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.